Throughout history, humans have had the impulse to explore, to discover what was around the next corner and adapt to it. The unknown, the wilderness, well, it has shrunk considerably, but the impulse to explore is still there. And we're going to see how it played out for two explorers in the wilds of Alaska. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me are James Campbell, author of Braving It, published by Broadway Books in 2017, and his daughter, Aiden. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
And in your case, welcome back, Jim.
Yeah,
we've talked a couple of times about your diverse adventures. I mean, of course, Braving It is not by any means your first book. You have the one about ghost soldiers, which takes us into New Guinea and World War II.
Right.
And then you have written or at least documented the Great Lakes icebreakers.
Yeah, right.
And let me see, what am I leaving out? Some other really far-flung...
Sailing through Micronesia.
Adventure. Oh, yes, yeah, exactly.
Right. I think you interviewed me about that
for public television. Yes,
right.
That's right. So it's not, at least on the face of it, as if you were drawn just to Alaska. I think you're drawn as much to adventure as you are to that particular place, or is that a miscalculation?
No, that's not a miscalculation. I think that Alaska has always occupied a special place in my imagination, but then again, so is Micronesia and New Guinea and the Great Lakes and a whole lot of other places. You might, in the book, you might have remembered what my mom said that I had. She said I didn't have wanderlust, but I had what the Germans call Fernweh, which is a longing, kind of a deep longing for far-flung places. And I think that's certainly true. And I probably passed on a little bit of that willingly, intentionally and unintentionally to my daughter, Aiden.
Well, that's an interesting point, because do you think, Aiden, that you had that wanderlust or the desire to see the far-flung places before you were, immersed in Alaska?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just growing up in Wisconsin, I was exposed to wilderness on a smaller scale, maybe, but we still have a beautiful and incredible nature in our own backyard, and I was able to experience that with my dad from a very young age. He took me hunting in the back marsh. He took me canoeing down the Wisconsin River. So I think he really inspired me, and I guess the apple doesn't fall from the tree.
The irony, because that gets into something having to do with homing, too. I mean, there is this push-pull, isn't there?
Yeah,
I mean, you can't, at least not everyone can spend their whole life just wandering.
No.
Some people need that groundedness, and you have, at the ripe old age of mid-teens, that sense of grounded.
Yeah, I felt like Wisconsin gave me roots, and I feel very connected with a piece of land that we have. We're from Lodi, Wisconsin. We have a small farm there. And so I can get out in nature whenever need be. But I still always had this dream of going to Alaska. Alaska was this goal for me because I've been hearing stories about it since I was very young. When I was 5 years old, my dad went to Alaska on his first trip to write the book The Final Frontiersman, which focuses on Haimo, his cousin, and Edna, who live there and have lived there for the last 40 years following the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, the last frontiersmen. And so when my dad came back, he told me all of these stories about his experiences, and I dreamed of going there one day. And when I was 15 years old, he finally took me.
You were not a stranger to, adventure before that, though.
No, I guess not. I had smaller adventures, for sure. My grandparents have a place in the UP, and it was actually the island that we're on is the Leshino Islands, where Elder Leopold went during his summers. And of course, I've read Elder Leopold. I'm a huge fan of his. And my dad would take me out in the canoe, and we'd go to the back bay, and we'd dig up Indian arrowheads together. So, yeah, I definitely had smaller adventures, too, but alas, Alaska was the great one.
And I should say that it wasn't just me. Aiden's mom, my wife Elizabeth, is also, she's a mountain gal. She loves the outdoors. spent much of her life, you know, backpacking and traipsing around. In fact, we went to New Guinea for our honeymoon. An odd place to take it.
Not everyone's first
honeymoon.
Choice. True.
We scaled, hiked mountains and hiked through the jungle. She ultimately got malaria, which was unfortunate. You may remember that story. But anyway, so Aiden comes by it very honestly from both her parents and probably her grandparents too.
Does the Arctic have a special appeal, though? You don't have to worry too much about malaria, but you do have to worry about some other things.
Well, you got to worry about mosquitoes, that's for sure. People always express surprise when we tell them about the clouds of mosquitoes in the Arctic. And, you know, it's a desert. It gets 14 inches of precipitation a year. But the thing is, because of the permafrost, all that snow and ice, when it melts, it has nowhere to go. The ground can't absorb
pooling.
It. So you have these little temporary pools and ponds and puddles everywhere, and the mosquitoes use the opportunity to hatch by the trillions. They drove us virtually crazy when we were, particularly when we were building the cabin.
Most people say that the grizzlies are the danger up there, but I called the mosquitoes the real beasts of the northern wild. Edna, Haimo's wife, what she says about the mosquitoes is she says, you kill one and the rest show up for the funeral.
And for the feast that comes after.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Well, what was your goal for this first trip that you took together? What was the plan?
Well, the first trip was kind of almost an accidental trip. The first trip was originally when I was writing The Final Frontiersman, as Aiden said, I'd come home and I'd tell all these stories. I'd tell them to all my friends and family. And eventually, when people saw me coming, they'd walk the other way because they thought I'd tell them yet another Alaska story. But Aiden was just ravenous. She couldn't get enough. But she was smart enough to exact a promise from me that one day we would go. But all along, we'd been planning for a backpacking and river trip. And then about 2 months before we were going to go, maybe 6 weeks, Haimo, my cousin, and as Aiden said, the subject of the first book, called me and said that his cabin was being washed away by the river, which had rerouted itself. And he said, Jimmer, he said, I want you to come up. I really need your help. And I said, well, I don't know, Haimo. Aiden and I have this trip planned. And he said, well, please tell me, because I'm desperate. Tell me if you can make it. So I consulted with Aiden, and she thought about it a bit. And the next morning, she came down very confidently and said, yes, I want to do it. And I reminded her that it wasn't going to be the adventure that we'd planned. It was going to be really hard work, which it was. But I then called Haimo up in Fairbanks. He'd just come out of the bush, and he was in Fairbanks. And I said, all right. And Haimo said, yes, Jimmer, thank you so much. And then I said, we're in. And then there was this long pause, and he said, who's the we? And then I proceeded to tell him, and he said, well, that ain't a good idea. And I said, well, you know, essentially we're a package deal. Will you take us? And he said, yeah, come on up. So that was the origin of that first trip is we'd had something else planned, but decided to go up and help him build a cabin.
And where exactly was this?
Well, he lives in far northeastern Alaska in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is 19.5 million acres of raw wilderness. Now, Aiden had spent time, as she said, in Wisconsin on the Ice Age Trail and the Wisconsin River and in the UP and Idaho and Colorado, but she'd never seen wilderness on this scale, and she'd never had to confront or worry about the presence of grizzlies, which, you know, you have to be a little bit concerned about at least.
And how close was the nearest help in case somebody, you know, broke a leg or came down with a bug of some kind?
The closest village was 100 miles from us, which also meant that was the closest human being. Mm-hmm. So we had a satellite phone in case of emergencies, but even in the event of emergency, even with a satellite phone, you're at least 24 hours from help. So when we were, you know, building the cabin, there were a lot of things that could have gone wrong. And And I was aware of those things, and obviously Aiden was aware of some of them, and Aiden's mom was very aware of some of those things. But I decided that it was worth it. There was a little bit of a risk, of course, but as far as I'm concerned, breaking out of your comfort zone is why we, is part of what's great about living.
Well, and there's a window, though. I mean, any assistance would come by air.
Would come by air.
And that would be dependent upon the weather.
There's no question about that.
So it could be a week.
Yeah. The weather is obviously a lot better in summer than it is in winter. That part of Alaska is much more flyable. But nevertheless, it could be a while.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I, of course, was worried, but I was more worried for my mother, I have to say. Having my father accompanying me, I trusted that he would only take me to a place that he felt I would be comfortable in. And
comfortable?
So, in a way, I was ignorance is bliss. And so I arrived quite chipper and quite enthusiastic about my experience. It was not the great adventure or the spiritual experience I had initially prepared myself for. And I realized that probably in the first week that this was not my river trip. I was working alone in a clearing, peeling 90 25-foot poles using a draw knife, which is a blade with two handles. Uh-huh. And so what you do is you take the draw knife and you pull it towards yourself again and again to strip the bark off the wood so that the wood doesn't rot. So this is extremely tiring activity. I was sweating under the sun, and I was just being feasted on by the mosquitoes, and of course I had bear on the brain. And we had a shotgun against the tree, and Haimo and my dad were working in the clearing probably 100 meters from where I was at the time. But of course, I was quite worried. In my head, every noise I heard was some grizzly just storming out of the bushes to come eat me alive. So that's how I passed the first week of my trip, in paranoia, I would say.
And how did that pan out in terms of when did you actually see a grizzly for that trip, ever?
We never saw a grizzly on that trip. We saw tracks on the gravel bars and the sandbars down by the river. But the truth is, people think in Alaska there's a grizzly hiding behind every willow waiting to jump on you. And the truth is, I think the range of a grizzly is 100 square miles or something like that. So you're not lucky to see one, but we didn't see one in 30 days. But yet the fear remains. There's no question about that. As it probably should. Aiden has a funny story about this bush pilot.
Yeah. So I was actually pretty comfortable with the topic of grizzlies before coming to Alaska. I was prepared. My dad and I had walked me through what I should do in any circumstance.
We use bear spray.
Yeah.
We practice that.
Mm-hmm. And I knew the chance of seeing one was low. That was essentially until I met this bush pilot. And about a week into my trip, this bush pilot came by to drop off supplies. And my dad and I went out to greet him. And at that time, I was wearing these bear bells around my neck.
And that's to warn the bear that you're there?
Exactly, exactly. Well, the bush pilot took one look at these bear bells, and he started laughing, howling, actually. And he points to them, and he goes, "Those bear bells?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Oh, good. That will help with the identification."
Right, because wouldn't there be nothing left but the bells?
Yeah, and when I look confused and slightly annoyed, he continues, and he said, "When we find a big pile of bear crap with bells in it, we'll know it's you."
Very, very reassuring.
Yeah, so there's the reason for my paranoia.
Of course, that's the old Alaska gag. That's the old trick, and he had pulled it on Aiden, of course.
So building this cabin, had you built a cabin before?
No, this is my first one. Yeah.
So you were essentially just kind of on this one task of stripping these 90 logs.
After that, I did help with the rest of the cabin well, but that was my initial task. And Haimo initially gave it to me, and he didn't think I would be capable of it. He saw me the first day, and he said, "We're going to have to switch out. There's no way she could do it." And as soon as he said that, I knew I had to prove him wrong. And I'm a cross-country skier, so throughout the trip, I told myself this would make me the best cross-country skier in the whole of Wisconsin, repeating this motion again and again.
Did you have any sense of trying to preserve your the more feminine aspects of, in terms of like your hands, or you're worried about tearing them up. And
I did. So I brought along a little handheld mirror with me on my first trip, and it was my one vestige of my teenage self. And after 7 hours of peeling poles and sweating and just smelling like the monkey cage at the zoo, I'd crawl into the tent and I'd take out my mirror and I'd look at myself in the mirror and I'd assess myself and I'd look myself up and down. I'd think, okay, not too bad. I'm doing pretty well for a girl in the Arctic. And then I'd turn to my dad and I'd go, okay, Dad, what grade? And he'd look at me and go, B+.
B+, yeah. Well, that's pretty good for the circumstances.
She was expecting the A, so she wasn't particularly happy about
that. No father who takes his daughter to the Arctic, to the wilderness, should ever give his daughter anything but an A.
Or an A+.
Well, yeah, grade on the curve, I would say.
Yeah, grade on a curve, for sure.
So I don't know if you've ever stripped or peeled poles, but these were old. Fish and Wildlife said that Haimo could use only these old dead trees to build his cabin. They didn't want him cutting down new trees. So when you're peeling live trees, the sap is running, so it's an easy peel. But these old dead trees, I mean, it is work just peeling one pole.
And you've got the knots, too.
And you got the knots, too, which you have to take the axe to. So that's
which
the first,
a bit dangerous
that's the
as
first
well.
Chore is knocking out all the knocks, making it smooth enough so that you can actually draw the draw knife back.
And that wood actually is lasts virtually forever, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Once
you strip it and
Once you strip it,
build it.
Of course, that's why they build cabins.
The cabin that Haimo and Edna are using currently, and it's probably the cabin they'll use for the rest of their life.
And how big was this cabin?
Not big.
Like, what, about
20 by 16.
20 by 16.
And that's the, size of a one-car garage. That's what they live in. But that's their home cabin. That's their biggest cabin. So they have two others in other areas of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, not far away. But they cycle through those cabins. They go to a different cabin in the spring of every year to let the land rebound from their presence.
Sort of a hunter-gatherer
like a farmer letting a field lie fallow.
So how long did it take to build this cabin?
Well, we were up there for a month. We got the roof on. There were still some little niceties and some inside work putting in the floor. But I'd say we built 90%, 95% of the cabin.
In the course of a month,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Haimo had done a little work before we'd gotten up there, but we worked hard for a month.
But you weren't staying in this cabin, obviously. Where were you staying?
No, we were staying in tents.
In tents, which is even in, late summer is a little hard to believe.
Yeah, it actually, people think of the Arctic in that it's cold all the time. Well, the temperature in that area of the Arctic can be 85 degrees in the middle of summer. So our first trip to the Arctic in the summer of 14, it was the worst bug summer in the interior of Alaska in 30 years. You go to Fairbanks, that was one of the first things we saw in the Fairbanks Newsminer, this big article about how buggy it was in the interior. And the next summer, when we were doing our backpacking and river trip, not to get ahead of ourselves, but it was the coldest summer in the Arctic. So as Aiden said, we're attracted to extremes.
Extremes. Well, it's a place of extremes.
It sure is.
Do you have a sense, you've been up there many times over the course of some years, Jim, has it changed? Do you have a sense that it has changed, even in this remote area of northeastern Alaska?
Well, I think at one time, from what I understand from this old hunter-trapper that I met in Fort Yukon, who's now over 90, there was a time when the moose, you didn't see them north of the Yukon River. Now you see the moose as far north as the Arctic Ocean. There are ticks now coming into Alaska. The glaciers in the Brooks Range are indeed melting. So, you know, of course, the climatologists say that Arctic Alaska in particular, or the Arctic in particular, is kind of ground zero for the kinds of climate changes we're going to be seeing. And also polar bears.
I was going to ask about those.
Polar bears are now more than ever coming in onto land. So you'll see them up around, well, they always did, but never so much, Kaktovik and Barrow, right on the Beaufort Sea or the Arctic Ocean. Once they'd be on the pack ice, hunting seals or whatever else. But now the pack ice is 500 miles off the coast.
So not an option for them.
So, yeah, I mean, they're wonderful swimmers.
They can go, what, about 100 miles?
Yeah, they can. They're tremendous swimmers, but that is a long swim, particularly for cubs. So, yeah, that is certainly changing. And, of course, the current administration has its sights set on opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling, the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Changes are happening, and sadly, more change could be coming.
And another has already been drilling, what, right off the northern coast of Alaska?
Drilling in the Arctic Ocean, mm-hmm. and also in the National Petroleum Reserve area, which is just west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So the coastal plain is this, you know, this little sliver of land. Comparatively, it's 1.5 million acres, so it's a lot of land, but compared to the refuge in general, it's small, and that's where the caribou calves from the porcupine caribou herd. So there are a lot of things that the drilling there could affect.
And they call the coastal plain the biological heart of the refuge. I mean, the Gwich'in, the indigenous Gwich'in, say it's the place where life begins because of the porcupine caribou herd. That's their birthing grounds. And you could see it. I mean, it's not necessarily beautiful by our traditional American standard. You know, it's not the Grand Canyon. It's not Denali. It's flat. It's floorboard flat. But it's a place that's alive with the rhythms of wilderness, and you're able to see that. We saw, you know, when we were portaging our canoe, we saw 1,000 ducks spooking from the tundra. You know, we saw a polar bear, actually, just off the coast. You know, we got to see caribou passing by on the river, and that's something that stays with you. It's a place that has inspired me, for sure.
Well, we're going to see what it is like in winter when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests, James Campbell, the author of Braving It, a father, daughter, and an unforgettable journey into the Alaskan wild, and the daughter in the title of the book, Aidan Campbell. And we're looking at their trips to Alaska. Now, it's one thing to be there in the summertime, the mosquitoes and the heat, but you actually went late fall into a very early winter, too, on a subsequent trip. What was the point of that?
Oh, that's a good question.
The cabin is built, you know, why are you going up there?
Well, at that point, I think after the first trip, I didn't know that there was going to be a book. I didn't know that we had a book. I thought, oh, maybe it would make for an interesting magazine article. And then when we came home, Aidan can talk about that a little bit more. But, you know, all the things she was looking forward to while we were there building the cabin, mostly running water, you know, and getting the dreadlocks out of her hair and the pine pitch. She had when we got home, you know, she had a toilet and a shower. But and she can articulate this way better than I can. But she said that there was something missing, and I noticed it. She seemed to be discontent and restless. Yeah. And then I said, are you interested in going back? And and before we left, Haimo said, hey, if you want to come back in winter, we could use your help. So I knew then that Aiden had passed muster, you know, that Haimo had decided she was a good worker. And yeah, so let's invite him back. So we did go back, and when we arrived on the river, the bush pilot put down, it was 28 degrees or below zero or something like that. And Aiden and I had gone shopping at Fred Meyer in Fairbanks, and we brought out all this fresh fruit and fresh vegetables. And when Haimo saw that, his eyes popped out of his head. I mean, they eat meat and more meat. So to get fresh fruit and vegetables, he was ecstatic. So he took Aiden back to the cabin, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but then he threw some snowshoes at me, and he said, you know, you're walking. So I stomped back to the cabin, and when I got there, Aiden and Haimo were standing in front of this tent, and I kind of hid behind the cabin wall, wondering what was going on, and I saw Haimo talking to her, and he would point to the cabin and then to the tent, and I would see Aiden look at the cabin and then at the tent. Before we'd left, Aiden said, Dad, do you think they're going to let us stay in the cabin, or are we going to be staying in the tent? Well, it became very obvious that first day that we were going to be staying in the tent. And Haimo said, so Aiden, this here tent we call the Arctic Oven. 3 days later, Aiden called it the Arctic Icebox.
Well, I mean, they do make tents that are really, you know, well, good in cold weather. But when you're talking 28 below, day after day.
Yeah, 40 below. And it had a little wood stove in it, but it was a small wood stove. So we were up three times a night. And if we catch the fire, then we could just put in two more little logs. But oftentimes we'd sleep through it, and then, you know,
start
at
over
30 below, you got to start all over. Yeah. It's painful.
That tent taught me how to swear.
Yes, they will do that.
Yeah.
So you brought fruit and vegetables. And what would people do in the Arctic traditionally before they could bring stuff in from Fairbanks?
Well, that's a really good question. Where Haimo is, it's accessible in the winter only by air. In the summer, perhaps by boat, depending upon the levels of the river. So Haimo lives very, very remotely. So if you're along one of the big rivers, the Yukon or the Porcupine River or some of the others, you can come up by boat and deliver supplies. Or when that river essentially becomes an ice, you know,
ice road,
then you could use dogs, you know, dog sled or by snow machine. So without the bush plane, Haimo would have a tough time getting anything at any point. And he usually doesn't. He'll get some supplies in winter once, and then that's it until May.
What would the... I assume there is, at least in the general vicinity, an indigenous population in that part of Alaska. What did they traditionally do? Just subsist on meat of some kind?
On the Yukon River, they'd subsist on salmon, and I think largely salmon, but also moose. Getting a moose is absolutely essential. Every fall, you want to get a moose because that much meat will carry your family through winter. A caribou won't. But in Arctic Village, which is directly west of where Haimo is, they depend on the caribou herds. And they prior to the gun, they corral caribou, and then they'd stone them or spear them or club them to death. Now they depend on the migration of the caribou. But of course, these days, there are also little dry goods stores in all the villages.
But they would have done for long periods of time without vegetables.
There's no growing season.
You can't eat the tundra, I guess.
Yeah, you'd have blueberries, and then you'd have cloudberries or salmonberries in summer and some roots.
It inspires what we call bush eyes, which is where you have this this desire for things that you can't have, specifically food.
Uh-huh.
For example, when we were up there, Haimo is, of course, subsistence hunting. So the majority of what we ate was meat. I had lynx, I had moose brains, I had caribou heart, liver, kidneys, beaver tail,
seal.
Porcupine, seal.
Yeah, well, I don't think, if I remember the book, you didn't much care for the beaver tail.
Oh, I was not a fan of the
beaver tail. I think, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the beaver tail. My dad has a wonderful way of describing beaver tail.
Yeah, the way, what I say is, imagine cooking fried chicken in a cast iron, you know, pot or pan, and in Crisco, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And when the chicken is done, throw the chicken in the wastebasket and eat the Crisco.
That's good.
Yeah. Huh?
But I guess it'll get you through.
Yeah. It will. I mean, we took sticks of butter and ate them like popsicles while I was up there.
You need fat.
Yeah.
This smacks of Lewis and Clark.
Sure.
You know, very heavy on a lean meat diet. I mean, that's because that's what was there.
It was available.
But they did get to this point where they started eating candles because they had this urge to get the fat in their diet.
I'm sure they experienced bush eyes as well.
Yeah.
I made long lists of everything that I was going to eat, grocery lists of what I was going to get. And when I walked into the grocery store, Fred Meyer, after I got out of the bush and back, I stayed in there for about 2 hours, just wandering back and forth through the stalls.
Yeah, and of course, butter is a caloric bomb. So that's what you need. But Haimo's daughters, when he and Edna raised on the river, used to do that all the time. They'd come out of the bush for maybe 2 months out of every year, and they'd make these lists, you know, of the foods they wanted to eat.
Well, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
You hunted?
Yes. On one occasion in particular, I, for the most part, hunted with Edna. And Edna is Haimo's wife, and she's a Yupik Eskimo from St. Lawrence Island, and she is a wilderness woman in her own right. Her father was one of the leaders of the native community on the island, and so he taught her everything he knew. And while I was up there, she passed on those skills to me. So she taught me how to set snares, she taught me how to trap, she taught me how to read the different colors of the river ice and how to listen for open water. And together, we actually butchered a caribou, which was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. It was so cold that day. It was 35 below, and I could barely hold the knife. And so what she did is she slit open the intestinal cavity, and she took my hands, and she guided them inside the steaming opening.
How sweet.
And when I took them out, they were wet with blood, and they were dripping and steaming in the snow, but I could finish the task.
But they were warm.
And they were warm.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen The Revenant, and there's one scene in The Revenant, and I don't know if you remember this, but Leonardo DiCaprio climbs inside the carcass of the horse to keep warm. And I have to say, I've never found him more attractive than that moment.
So how long does it take under those circumstances to dress out a caribou?
Well, we did it pretty quickly.
To skin it and butcher it. You know, Edna's an expert. It would have taken me alone much longer than it took Edna and Aiden. But what, it maybe took you an hour?
An hour.
In 35 degrees below zero.
Yeah, you have to do it quickly,
with occasional breaks.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing goes to waste?
No.
Very, very,
very little.
You eat all the organs.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, that's what the polar explorers discovered when they met the, you know, the Inuits on the Arctic coast, is that they ate organs, and the organs are really essential. They're just full of vitamins and minerals. They eat the face, the little fatty area in the cheek.
Sure.
They eat, you know, they make head cheese, you know, they eat the brains, they eat the moose tongue, you know, or caribou tongue.
Did you mention eyeballs?
Yes, eyeballs too.
Yeah.
No, we didn't have that. And no, but very, very little goes to waste. They can't afford to waste anything.
And you use the hide also then?
They'll use the hide. Less so now than before, but they once used to have caribou hide blankets. But that's kind of, nearly a thing of the past.
So in the day after day, it's well below zero in this environment. And did you ever have concerns about, like, frostbite or, you know, just getting caught out there a little too long?
Yeah, well, Haimo and I would go on his line probably 30 miles from the cabin.
This would be trapping.
On his trap line by snow machine. And of course, if your snow machine breaks down there, he brings snowshoes, you're walking back, and you're not going to make 30 miles in one day. So you have to know how to build a temporary shelter and know how to keep warm.
And know how to build a fast
and
fire.
Know how to build a fast fire, which at 40 below is very hard to build a fire. There's no fuel for the fire. It's just hard to fuel the fire. And we had an incident where we rolled the snow machine and had to dig it out of a big snowbank, and we couldn't start it after that. And we took all the spark plugs out, dried them off, put them back in, still couldn't start it. And miraculously, somehow, it started. But we were envisioning walking, I think at that point it was 22 miles back to the cabin. And it was probably 30 or, 32 below at that time. So, yeah, that's a worry. And you always worry about river ice.
Yeah.
That's what Edna taught Aiden,
river
how to read the river ice.
Thin,
yeah, the different colors. And we experienced a warm-up there, and then there was a snow cover, so it was especially difficult. And on one occasion, Edna and I were going to check her snares, and we were walking along the river, and we had to cross the river at one point. And I had, of course, a stick just in case. If you fall in, you have something to catch you.
I always thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
Even walking across Lake Mendota seems like a good idea.
Yeah, but at the edge of the bank, my foot went in, and I had a boot on, but my foot was completely wet. She pulled me out, but we immediately had to go back to the cabin because, things can happen, and I did not want to lose that foot. I have had frostbite in a number of my toes.
Not irreversible frostbite,
not irreversible.
At least.
Yeah. And you got frostbite on your ears on that trip. Yeah.
As well.
So what kind of things would you catch in these snares, and how did you make the snares?
Well, Haimo had already... set out all the snares in trapping starts early November, I think. So they trap wolverine, they trap wolves, they trap beaver in
Martin.
Not at that time. In
so
March.
He's selling the pelts.
He's selling fur. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the only way they can afford to live out there, and it's of course people have done that for hundreds of years. But what you see now is what they call trust fund homesteaders are people who are buying, say, a native allotment, doctors, lawyers from Anchorage or whatever, and then they come out, but they come out with all the amenities, And so Haimo obviously does trap, but I would say that the so-called trust fund homesteaders are much harder on the land than Haimo and Edna are. And as I said, they do cycle through those cabins. So they don't ever trap an area out, or for that matter, hunt an area out, which is impossible, because
this is a large area that you're talking about. It's still, I guess, a fairly sparse number of people doing this. But so it is legal within certain limits for people to hunt and trap in this refuge.
Yeah, for rural residents, but Haimo, because he was in what is today the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, before it became a wildlife refuge, he got there in 75 or 76, he was grandfathered in. So Haimo and Edna and their family were grandfathered in, but their occupation of that land ends with the death of their children, the death of their two daughters. So there are seven families with a permit to live and trap and hunt in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Is the game, this might be a question that is maybe too simple to ask, but is the game harder to come by than in the winter?
Well, you shoot caribou when they're migrating, so you hope that they're going to migrate through your area. And sometimes they come and sometimes they don't.
You can't put out salt licks.
You can't put out salt licks, right? You don't have a little food plot, you know, that you're attracting them with. And the moose, and that's why the moose is essential, because the moose, you're going to get a lot of meat.
But more plentiful now, you say.
But more plentiful north of the Yukon River, certainly, than ever before. And they also eat other things, muskrat and beaver tail and mink, etc.
Snowshoe hare,
yeah.
Which we were snaring on that occasion.
Now, do you have a favorite among these animals that you had not eaten before, Aiden?
I think it's caribou heart.
Caribou heart.
Even now, yeah. I tend to miss it. I'll be given a New York strip and I'll say, oh, where's the caribou heart? That's what I have a hankering for.
Do you have a sense that that these trips, and we'll get to the third one in a minute, the river trip, do you have a sense that these have kind of spoiled you in a way that, I mean, you can't go back fully to, civilization?
That's interesting that you ask that, because that's what happened to me following the first trip. You know, it was on the first trip, there are moments where I felt that the work was a lot, and there were moments where I was a bit unhappy, and I missed home, I missed running water, I missed my friends, I missed the internet. But I also had a breakthrough at that point, and I think I realized where I was, that I was in 20 million acres of raw wilderness. I mean, who had that? At that time, I had that. I would wake up in the morning, you know, and I'd make a fire for breakfast. I'd pick tundra berries, you know, salmon berries on the tundra. I'd fish for my supper every night. The sun, for example, the sun never set on my first trip. I'd wake up at 2 a.m. and it was still up. And so I really had this transformative experience. I experienced what Wallace Stegner calls the birth of awe. And that's what happened to me while I was up there. So I did go home after that month, and I realized that I missed it. I missed Alaska. I finally had everything I had been wanting, and all I wanted to do was be back up there.
Does that work?
You know, and that's what happened with our second trip. I did have that opportunity. Uh-huh. Now I just realize I have to find those opportunities on a smaller scale. And so I do go out, you know, I go out in my backyard, I go out hiking with my sisters, and I want to go back to Alaska. But I found adventures and wildernesses close by as well.
Well, we'll follow this river trip with my guests. Mm-hmm. On a river with a rather improbable name when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests, James Campbell, the author most recently of Braving It, A Father, A Daughter, and An Unforgettable Journey into the Alaskan Wild, and his daughter, Aiden, who was the participant in those adventures. And we've looked at two trips they made to Alaska, one in the summer, one in the fall, into the late fall. And the third one is actually a river trip. And I mentioned this improbable name. I'm not sure anybody knows why this river way up in northeast Alaska is called the Hula Hula. But obviously it had some kind of attraction for you.
Yeah, well, I've always loved the name and always loved that country. I think it was named by whalers from the Sandwich Islands, or, you know, the Hawaiian whalers that they'd bring up there.
Did they go that far up?
They'd conscript and they'd bring them up there. Uh-huh. And I think they named the Hula Hula River because they saw the river as it came toward the coastal plain and it winds like that.
And I suspect they'd been at sea too long also.
They'd been at sea far too long. So that last trip was the trip that Aiden had been dreaming of since the age of 5 years
that
old.
That particular trip.
It was my great adventure.
That particular river.
Crossing the Brooks Range and then from there, taking that river down to the Arctic Ocean. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
up to the Arctic
and
Ocean.
We did it with two very good buddies out of Palmer, Alaska. One of the buddies did my I did the expedition across New Guinea with me. So they were, you know, great partners to have, and they taught Aiden even more wilderness skills. And of course, it was good to have two extra people with us in case of emergency. But they were really good traveling companions. But that was, as I said, the trip that I was dreaming of too, a backpacking trip. We backpacked over the Brooks Range, got to the headwaters of the improbably named Hula Hula River, and then assembled our folding canoe and canoed out to the Arctic Ocean. And it was exhilarating and terrifying.
And it also sounded somewhat grueling, too. I mean, yeah. You think of, oh, the white water and the rapids and not necessarily knowing exactly what to expect. I assume, though, is you had some kind of charts to work with?
Yeah, we had maps. And before we went up, I was checking every day with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge office to see what the levels of the Hula Hula were.
Make a big difference,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, make a big, big difference. You can change a, you know, class 2-3 river to class 3-4. Well, what happened to us is, well, it's a class 2-3 river.
We're talking about the difficulty of the rapids
Yeah,
now.
Regularly. Mm-hmm. And we were ready for that. We had the paddling skills for that. But what happened on the backpacking portion of the trip is it rained and snowed a lot. And by the time we got to the Hula Hula River,
it was
considerably bigger mm-hmm. than we had imagined. But at that point, you know, we were in.
Yeah.
So, committed. Uh-huh.
So it challenged every skill we had. Yeah, and maybe more.
You practiced some in
on the Baraboo River,
yeah. Didn't you?
Yeah, definitely. That we were able to hone our skills in some way, but still, reaching the Hula Hula, it was a different beast entirely. Specifically, as my dad mentioned, because of the higher water. And when we were hiking over the Brooks Range, when we were backpacking over the Brooks Range, all I wanted to do was get to the Hula Hula River. I was carrying a 55-pound pack. My dad was carrying a 60-pound pack and a shotgun. Yeah. And we were hiking over muskeg. We were following caribou trails over scree slopes. And it was magnificent country. But at the same time, it was exhausting. And so I had this picture in my head of reaching the Hula Hula River. I would throw off my pack and I would just float down to the Arctic Ocean.
Of course.
And then I got the Hula Hula. And instead of finding the sweet river that was going to deliver me to my final destination, I found a raging beast of the river, you know, with cliff walls, roiling bowls of water, and class 3 rapids and rock gardens.
And Aiden just spent the summer as a guide mm-hmm. on the American River in California. So Alaska was kind of her training ground for California, or what maybe partially inspired mm-hmm. her to do it. But it was a challenging trip.
Yeah. And on top of that, we had the added obstacle of suddenly a role reversal, because I was in the bow of the boat as the lighter person. So it was my job to give instructions to my dad, who made the sweeping strokes in the stern.
Right.
And so initially we didn't know how to handle I didn't know how to handle this newfound responsibility. And he didn't know how to listen to me either. So we'd be going down and we'd be yelling back and forth over the roar of the rapids, and no one could hear each other, and he wasn't listening to me and I wasn't listening to him. There were multiple near disasters. And so I told my dad, I said, okay, Dad, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have to listen to me and I'll try to be better. I'll try to be more confident. And we're just going to have to see how it goes, because this is the only way we're going to reach the Arctic Ocean. And so he said, okay. And gradually I became more and more assertive and more confident. And then by the time we reached the Arctic Ocean, I was barking orders at my dad.
I
was the boss of the boat. And of course, how often do you get to yell at your parent? Not very often.
Well, survival can do that, I suppose.
Yeah.
The need for survival. You hung up on rocks a couple of times.
Yeah.
That required some extra power.
Yeah, it did. It was, reading the river was tough. It was a big river, and there were rock boulder gardens, and so you know, the canoe, wasn't that maneuverable. Plus, of course, we had it weighted down. So yeah, it was tough. And certainly, as parents, we're not used to relinquishing control. Uh-huh. And mm-hmm. so it quickly became obvious that my tactic wasn't working, you know, yelling at Aiden. So she had to assume a lot of responsibility and read the river on her own. But the more I shut up, the better she did. And that was a real kind of revelation for me, is to see, you know, her confidence and composure grow through the course of that trip. And, you know, that might have been the biggest, you know, the biggest gift of all.
Think so?
Oh, I think so. You know, it was interesting. My dad was letting go in a way. And on my winter trip with Edna gave me a lot of confidence, and she showed me what it meant to be courageous and bold. And she proved to me that I could be a wilderness woman. And then I think on that last trip, I really tested that, and I took charge. A lot of the time was hiking ahead during the backpacking portion. I had to assume more responsibility during the canoeing part. And it was interesting for me, because as my dad let go, I took on this new role, and I became more of a leader. And it's something that stuck with me, and I find it that it's a gift that he's given me, because now I feel that I can handle things, not just the Hula River, not just Alaska, but any challenge that comes up in my life.
Well, you of course have to know which ones to accept.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's always that discretion. Yeah. And that actually comes back to you in a way, Jim, because how do we put this delicately? As one becomes more mature,
you mean older.
There are certain things that one can no longer do or should not attempt, and you constantly have to come to terms with what those are.
Yeah, that's tough. Tough kind of facing middle age head on, and the occasional infirmities that accompany that, but. Yeah, I was carrying a very heavy pack and a shotgun, and I've had lots of knee operations. And I was surrounded by some of the most gorgeous scenery in the world, and I have to admit, sometimes I had my head down and I was just stomping across the landscape. Sometimes people ask, well, why such a heavy pack? But in the Arctic, you have to prepare for 80-degree weather, and then you have to prepare for 25-degree weather, and we got it all. So to be an ultralight backpacker is a virtual impossibility in the Arctic. But yeah, a portion of the book is also me coming to terms with, the fact that I'm growing old. And it's, you know, that's an unavoidable thing. And I think, you know, sometimes I handled it gracefully, and sometimes I handled it gracelessly.
And you kept, at least for a time, some things from Aiden, didn't you, about the AFib situation?
Yeah, so I had a bout of AFib on the trip. I actually got atrial fibrillation after hiking across New Guinea. I came down with malaria, and I came home, and one day my heart was out of rhythm. I didn't know what in the world was going on, and it persisted. And I ultimately had an ablation, which is a surgery to kind of knock out the rogue circuit. And I hadn't had an incident for 2.5 years. And we had a particularly hard day of backpacking, but we trained really hard before going on the trip, too. I don't know what happened, but suddenly my resting pulse had skyrocketed. And I didn't tell Aiden, and I didn't tell the two buddies accompanying us. I didn't want them to worry. Some people have said that was irresponsible of me, and I understand that. I don't feel personally that it was, but had it persisted through the night into the next morning, of course, then I would have told them, because I would have had to stop the trip right there. But by the following morning, I'd done deep muscle relaxation. Fortunately, I brought a little beta blocker along with me, and it tripped my heart back into normal rhythm. Now, I was tired the next 2 or 3 days, but I was capable of moving on. But not to make a long story even longer, but that was frightening.
What did you do when you got to the mouth of the Hulahula River?
I don't think my dad writes about this in his book, but along with our canoe, the bush pilot had dropped off supplies for the remainder of our journey. So suddenly we had a new stock of food, and I had set aside a lint chocolate bar. And the first thing I did was my reward. I grabbed that lint bar, I sat down right there on the bank, and I ate it. I ate the whole thing in one sitting.
Yeah.
And that was my reward.
Well, thanks for sharing your adventures with me for the summer.
We really enjoyed it.
Got a little bit of a flavor of it, and I'm sure you'll have some more.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I'm not ready to cash it in yet.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure having
you. Thank you very much.
James Campbell and Aidan Campbell, his daughter, who have braved it in Alaska and continue to brave it one place or another. Great to see you.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.